XE KBXE.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. The record-setting government shutdown is disrupting air travel, SNAP benefits, and the data that would tell us how the economy is doing. We'll have the latest from the White House and Congress. The U.S. Treasury will stop making pennies, but right now, businesses that deal in cash are feeling the pinch. We talked to an expert who says it's time to let the penny go.
We've been losing a lot of money making these pennies, and we're wasting our time, and our time is valuable.
Plus, how parents can be good screen time role models for their kids. It's Sunday, November 9th. News is next.
For KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with a special edition of the Up North Report. We're introducing a new series, North Star Students. We want to highlight Northern Minnesota students who deserve to be recognized, whether that's for their athletic accomplishments, artistic endeavors, academic achievements, or other efforts. Here's what you can expect. With each North Star student, we'll have an interview with them on the KAXE Morning Show. There will also be a feature story and photos on our website, kaxe.org. Our first ever North Star student is Bemidji senior Abby Damon. She was nominated by her swim coaches, Lisa Freet and Danielle Bartz. They say Damon is really stepping up as a leader this year, volunteers many hours, and is a strong, silent example of what hard work can look like. Here's an excerpt of our interview with Damon and Bartz, starting with why she was nominated.
Just wonderful human being. She's a hard worker. She's positive. She's encouraging, good athlete or good student athlete. And so I think she's kind of got a good holistic picture of, or like working towards, you know, the academic and the athlete part, and being a good role model for everybody. She's inspiring to me every day. So that she'd be a perfect candidate.
Do you have any favorite Abby memories?
Oh, man. I don't know if I can think of anything on the spot. She's just a joy to work with every day. She's always working hard, which is awesome to see. And just smiley. And I'm trying to think of like a fun story, but
Fargo.
West. Every single one. We have a West Fargo invite every year, and I think even this year she was sick. Every year she's been sick. The first year I was with the team, we ended up having to pull over because she was barfing on the bus. but she's still like, she was a trooper about it, and so this year she got to compete again, which was exciting. But still got sick. She's consistent. We like to talk about that quite a bit, I guess.
Abby, I wanted to ask you, what achievement in swimming are you most proud of?
I think I'm really proud that I've always kind of kept like a positive mindset about things. Like sometimes after a bad race, I'm like, oh my gosh, like that was just awful. But I've never like tore myself down to a point where I'm just like, I'm absolutely not doing this anymore. And also achievement, I just hope I have made a lasting impact on the younger girls on the team and that they can look up to me. And hopefully in the future, they want to be like have some of my traits too. So
what about outside of swimming? As your, you know, senior year, you're looking back quite a bit. What are some of your kind of accomplishments, whether in school or in other activities that you're proud of and thinking about a lot these days?
I'm really proud of like my work ethic, especially in school. Like, I go home and I have a routine every night, and I do homework for, like, 2.5 hours, and it sucks. But also, like, you feel good when you have the grades you do. So school has been a big accomplishment for me.
And Danielle, is there anything? I don't think Abby's the bragging type, so is there anything she didn't say that she should have?
No, I think she's got it. Yeah, I'm glad that you're proud of how you're working hard in school and in the water. And seeing that, putting all that hard work and the time, and like it really can suck sometimes a lot, like it's worth it. And she's able to see that and know that it's going to be paying off in the end.
That was our first North Star student, Bemidji senior Abby Damon, and her swim coach, Danielle Bartz. Visit kaxe.org for photos and more on Damon, including the full interview. There, you can also nominate someone you know for North Star student. We want to highlight students that might not always be in the spotlight, but deserve to be recognized. That's it for this special edition of the Up North Report. Find more of our stories and photos at kaxe.org, where you can also find content from our music, phonology, and morning show teams. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is made possible by Woodland Bank, providing customers with personal and business banking solutions, as well as offering Kasasa checking accounts. You can learn more online at woodland.bank.
Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. 40 days into a record-breaking government shutdown, and the consequences are becoming more severe. Some food banks are scrambling to serve unpaid federal workers and people who rely on SNAP benefits, while there's a court fighting over those benefits. The Federal Aviation Administration has begun reducing air traffic, and key economic data is not being released by the federal government. Joining me now is NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith. Good morning, Tam.
Good morning, Aisha.
So let's start briefly with SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. What's the latest on that?
Yeah, SNAP is the nation's largest anti-hunger program, but funding ran out more than a week ago. The Trump administration's position is that it can't tap reserve funds, as has been done in past shutdowns. So there's been a flurry of legal action, and as a result, some payments have gone out. On Friday, the Trump administration appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court and got a temporary stay. All of which is to say that there are millions of people in this country whose ability to buy food is in limbo. And the cleanest solution would be to end the government shutdown. But that is easier said than done.
Okay, well, let's talk about the economic data blackout. What do we know about the state of the U.S. economy without a monthly jobs report or information about retail sales?
Yeah, Friday marked the second month without that all-important jobs report. The last report from August showed anemic job growth and the unemployment rate ticking up. What we did get this week was some private data, which provides an incomplete but concerning picture. A report from the outplacement firm Challenger Gray and Christmas tallied 153,000 job cuts in October and hiring at its lowest point in 14 years. And consumer confidence, measured by the University of Michigan, took a hit too, with the shutdown dragging on and inflation worries growing. In addition to there being economic consequences, there are real political consequences too when people don't feel good about the state of the economy.
But Tam, we've been told for over a year now that President Trump was elected because Americans were very unhappy about the economy. And it seems like you're telling me they're still unhappy. But the state of the economy proved to be a winning issue for Democrats in last week's election. What's the message now from the White House?
A top Trump political advisor acknowledged during a Politico podcast interview that the president needs to pivot to affordability. And in just the past few days, the president has been talking about it a lot, which is a change from before the election. And he keeps getting asked about people's concerns about the cost of living as that has happened. He's been getting pretty defensive. On Thursday, he even said he didn't want to talk about affordability, which led to this on Friday.
The fake news yesterday, they talked about that. They said, oh, I don't want to talk about affordability. The reason I don't want to talk about affordability is because everybody knows that it's far less expensive under Trump than it was under sleepy Joe Biden.
Egg prices are down from the peaks they hit early in the Trump administration. Gas prices are down somewhat, though not as cheap as the president has been claiming. Beef prices are up, so Trump said he's ordering an investigation into meat packers. But at least in part because of Trump's tariffs policy, inflation has been persistent this year. The reality is presidents don't have that many levers to juice the economy or bring prices down. Promising to fix the economy is a great campaign message, but it is harder to deliver on. Just this morning, President Trump posted that we are the richest and most respected country in the world. He said 401ks are the highest ever. But voters are getting daily reminders of how their own personal economy is doing.
Okay, does that mean that there's more pressure to end this shutdown standoff?
The pressure points keep growing, but so far this shutdown has been immune to all kinds of pressure. Senate Democrats offered to vote for a government funding bill if it includes a one-year extension of health care tax subsidies that are expiring and giving people major sticker shock. That was rejected immediately by Republicans. Meantime, President Trump has been in Florida this weekend posting on social media a lot of all caps ideas that so far have been non-starters, like terminating the filibuster in the Senate and addressing the health insurance cliff by giving people money directly.
That's NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keefe. Thanks, Tam.
You're welcome.
It's been more than 2 years since the start of Sudan's civil war, a conflict that's brought widespread devastation and famine to parts of the country. But now the Trump administration is intensifying diplomatic efforts to end the fighting that's killed tens of thousands of people. The two warring parties, Sudan's paramilitary rapid support forces, commonly known as the RSF, and the country's army, have previously agreed to ceasefire proposals only for them to fall apart. To discuss this, we're joined by Alex Duvall. He's the executive director of the World Peace Foundation at Tufts University and a Sudan scholar. Welcome to the show.
It's good to be with you.
We should start in Darfur, which has seen intense fighting in recent weeks. What do we know about the situation there?
So the RSF overran the capital city of North Darfur, a city called Al-Fasher, which was the last government garrison holding out against it. And immediately following that capture, the most horrible atrocities unfolded. And they didn't unfold in the dark. The killers themselves videotaped themselves, killing unarmed civilians, torturing, tormenting captives, and then casually shooting them as they smiled. And we don't know how many thousand people have been killed. As well as this appalling death toll, every single child who is being admitted to clinics run by charities nearby, every single one is malnourished, and we don't know how many hundreds, if not thousands, have starved to death.
We should note that the RSF has denied targeting civilians, but the group was accused of carrying out genocide by the Biden administration. How significant is the capture of that city to the outcome of this war?
So what it does is it means that the RSF is in control of almost all of the towns west of the River Nile. And now the country is increasingly looking to be divided geographically, essentially along that river, which runs through the center of the country from the south to north. So we have the army controlling one side, the RSF controlling the other, a sort of de facto partition of the country.
This conflict is between the country's army and this paramilitary group. Can you tell us more about the RSF and its leader?
So 20 years ago, many of your listeners will have been familiar with the name Janjaweed. There was a genocide in Darfur, and an irregular militia was mobilized by the government of Sudan as the spearhead for its counterinsurgency. And it went on the rampage through Darfur, killing, burning, looting, raping. And that Janjaweed force evolved into the RSF. The government was told to disarm it. It refused. In fact, it could never have seriously disarmed it. They've become so powerful. And one of the RSF commanders, a man called Mohammed Hamdan Dagalo, he's widely known as Hemeti, became its chief. And he became not only a capable military commander, but also a businessman. He controlled Sudan's largest gold reserves. He rented out his troops to fight as mercenaries in Yemen in particular, but also in other places like Libya. So he runs a sort of commercial military operation of these utterly ruthless and determined fighters who are unfortunately a match for the regular army.
The Trump administration says it's working to end the fighting. What are these efforts and how significant are they?
So the Biden administration completely failed on this. It really did next to nothing. Now, Secretary of State Marco Rubio has got the formula right. And what he's trying to do is to get the neighboring Arab countries, which are Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates, that have taken different sides. He wants to get them around the table. And he has got them in principle to agree to a plan, starting with a humanitarian ceasefire, followed by political negotiations to restore a civilian-led government. On Thursday, the RSF said it would adopt a ceasefire. Now, you need two for a ceasefire. And what it appeared to be doing was it just wanted to improve its reputation after these terrible massacres were exposed. It's not actually observing the ceasefire. Its drones are attacking other cities in Sudan. And the other side has not agreed to it. The other side is vowing revenge, saying it will continue fighting. So there really is no ceasefire.
What are the chances of success?
So there are two things that really need to happen. One is the United Arab Emirates, which backs the RSF, needs to use its leverage on the RSF. And there's some signs it might be beginning to do that. The other is that other countries in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and also Turkey and Qatar, that have leverage on the other side, to get them to agree. If that were to happen, it could at least begin to stabilize the situation, and Sudanese could begin to see a possible way out of the current calamity.
That's Alex Duvall from Tufts University. Thank you so much for joining us.
You are very welcome.
You're listening to NPR News.
You are listening to Weekend Edition this Sunday morning here on member-supported radio KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Find the latest Up North report at KAXE.org. News from our region. Heard on the morning show, World Cafe, and All Things Considered, or as a podcast. Is there news in your region we should know about? Email news at KAXE.org. Fire in the Village hosts the Creative Crow Club the first Wednesday of each month from 4 to 6 at Old Central School in Grand Rapids. Youth can explore their artistic gifts, find their voice, and build a caring community. You can become a Minnesota Master Naturalist during a 5-day training at Long Lake Conservation Center in Palisade, January 17th through the 21st. Find more information and register at minnesotamasternaturalist.org/courses. And now we'll take you back to Weekend Edition here on member-supported radio, KAXE KBXE.
I'm Giles Snyder with these headlines. The Senate is working this weekend, seeking a way out of the government shutdown that's now in its 40th day. Senators will meet again today as President Trump pushes Republicans to get rid of the filibuster to bring the funding fight to an end. Syrian President Ahmed al-Sharaa is in Washington. He is to meet with President Trump at the White House tomorrow. His visit comes 2 days after the U.S. dropped his status as a specially designated global terrorist. And health officials are investigating a series of botulism cases across 10 states. The cases are linked to baby formula that the FDA says is being recalled. No deaths, but 13 infants have been hospitalized. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Capital One, offering their dining and entertainment card, Saver. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at RWJF.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Living in a polarized society is taking a toll on Americans' mental health. That's according to the latest results of an annual survey by the American Psychological Association. More than 60% of adults who responded to the survey say that divisions in society are a major source of stress for them. NPR's health correspondent Ritu Chatterjee is here to tell us more. Hi, Ritu.
Hey, Aisha.
What else did the survey find?
The survey also uncovered a perhaps deeper emotional crisis in the country, which is increasingly being recognized as a major public health issue, and that's loneliness and social isolation. Half or more of the respondents say that they feel isolated from others, they feel left out and lack companionship. And interestingly, you know, those who said that they are stressed by societal divisions in the country are more likely to report feeling lonely and disconnected than those who say they aren't stressed out by how divided the country is right now. Here's psychologist Vail Wright with the American Psychological Association.
It's almost like a double whammy. If you feel like you are being personally impacted by the level of social divisiveness in the country, then there seems to be some degree of which you also feel like you cannot reach out to others and address this sense of disconnection and this sense of loneliness.
And studies show that loneliness and isolation do take a toll on one's mental health.
Can you say more about the implications for mental health? Mm-hmm. Did the survey look into that as well?
Yes, it did. And respondents who reported feelings of loneliness and isolation were also more likely to say they've adopted some bad coping behaviors, according to Wright.
Canceling social plans, having difficulty planning for the future, having difficulty making decisions, not taking care of themselves, and even more starkly, not taking care of responsibilities, whether at work, at home, or with their families.
And, you know, Wright says that both high levels of stress and social isolation are linked to physical and mental health symptoms.
That can look like headaches, fatigue, stomach problems, as well as increased levels of depression and anxiety.
And all of this has been well documented by previous research.
Well, is there anything in the survey results that offers a glimmer of hope or mm-hmm. insight into what people can do to feel more connected to others?
I'm so glad you asked that. Wright says that every year when they do the survey, they also ask respondents whether they can have a positive impact on their own lives.
Inevitably, everyone says yes. Yes, that they can. Yes, that they do have the ability to make things better for themselves and that they see a bright future for themselves. And I always think that that is such a quintessential, hopeful fact that we need to hold on to.
And she says that's particularly important when so much feels out of our control, which brings me to the other part of your question about what people can do to feel more connected. And Wright says focusing on things that one can control is key. So, you know, we may not be able to bridge political divides, but we can call or text a loved one we haven't seen or heard from for a while, or do something nice for friends, family, neighbors, or maybe volunteer at an organization whose values align with our own so we can contribute to our communities in a positive way. And all of these things, Wright says, can really chip away at that sense of disconnection.
That's NPR's health correspondent, Ritu Chatterjee. Thank you so much for stopping by.
Always a pleasure, Aisha.
Penny pinchers are turning into nickel pinchers. President Trump ordered the Treasury in February to stop minting new pennies. And for many businesses that deal with cash, that has meant trouble at the register. Making exact change is not always possible. Round up and risk angry customers. Round down and take a loss. Robert Waples is a professor of economics at Wake Forest University and joins us now. Thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me on.
You've been a longtime advocate for getting rid of the penny, but you don't hate pennies. I want to clarify that. Well, why get rid of the penny?
I published an article actually 18 years ago saying that it was time to get rid of the penny, to stop minting them. The basic reason is that there's not really a rounding tax, it turns out. If you look at actual cash register totals, they don't always end in nines and therefore would get rounded up to the next nickel or dime. They're kind of totally random. So when you get rid of the pennies and you're still doing a cash transaction, you will round now to the nearest nickel and it pretty much breaks even. And so since we've been losing a lot of money making these pennies and we're wasting our time and our time is valuable, that's why I thought it's time to get rid of the penny.
It's coming to fruition, but are you surprised that we're talking about penny shortages this early? Because the U.S. Treasury estimated there wouldn't be shortages until next year. But according to the National Retail Federation, retailers, banks, and other businesses that rely on pennies have reported shortages in markets across the country.
I am a little bit surprised that it's going this fast. In fact, I kind of envisioned it taking years or decades to kind of totally unfold. But I guess the key is this. Banks don't give you a free ride on the pennies. And so it costs them money to deal with the pennies and package the pennies and doing all that stuff. So they're charging retailers more than 50 cents for a roll of 50 pennies. That's why the retailers now don't want to mess around with it.
Okay. What should businesses do if they don't have the pennies and they can't make exact change? Some businesses are saying if they round down, they're going to have losses.
First of all, it's only on cash transactions, and the vast, vast majority of our transactions are not cash anymore. But for those cash ones, the first thing that the retailer can do is hang up a little sign saying, hey, we've run out of pennies. Can you guys bring them in? And if they do, problem solved. And so then what's going to have to happen is people are just going to get used to rounding the cash amount. And they'll feel hurt sometimes. Dang it, I lost 2 cents. But if they pay attention and they're an average person, it'll break even over time.
For the businesses themselves, you don't think that they'll have significant losses because of the lack of the penny. You think that they'll be able to work that out?
I don't think so. So the paper that I published 18 long years ago, I got some convenience store data. It was like about 180,000 observations of cash register totals. And this was for the Wilco chain, which is headquartered here in Winston-Salem. And there were like 20 stores up and down the East Coast. And I looked at them all and I looked at the last digit and how would the rounding break? And I found that, in fact, if you rounded it, the customer wins ever so slightly, something like a 40th of a cent on average when there's rounding. That's what I found in my data set. I would suspect that's not a heck of a lot different than zero. And so the customer or the business, once in a while, they come out 2 cents ahead or 1 cent ahead. Once in a while, 2 cents ahead or 2 cents behind. But it all really is about to break even in the long run. That's the way I see it.
Looking at the nickel, it costs about 14 cents to produce. Should we ditch that one too?
Well, you know, the dominoes are falling, and so the nickel's turn will be next. I don't know when that will be. I don't really take a stand on whether or not we should get rid of the nickel at this point. But, you know, the last time we got rid of a coin was the half penny, and that was all the way back in 1857. So that's 170 whatever years before we got rid of the penny after that. So I don't know if it's going to take that long to get rid of the nickel, but I wouldn't be surprised if it takes quite a while just because of the inertia that we see in the American political system.
That's Robert Waples, professor of economics at Wake Forest University. Thank you so much for being with us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
This fall marks 80 years since the end of World War II.
I can talk about war experience and all that stuff.
Weekend Edition producer Samantha Balaban grew up hearing stories from her grandfather about his time in the Army.
Okay, you tell me when to start.
You can start whenever you're ready.
Do I have to give my name or anything like that?
Alvin Balaban served with the 3rd Battalion, 345th Infantry Regiment, 87th Division in the European Theater of Operations. He was in the Battle of the Bulge and the Siegfried Line campaign and spent 9 months overseas before sailing back to New York Harbor in 1945.
Everybody was crowding the rails to see New York and came on the Statue of Liberty, and I began to cry. Unbidden, just the sight of the statue standing there and home, which is what it represented to me, the tears just came flooding out.
Al Balaban was never sure he'd make it home. This Veterans Day weekend, his granddaughter Samantha shares one of his stories, recorded in 2012, about the day he didn't die in Europe.
Before I went into the Army, which was in 1943, the early part of 1943. I had been in college. I had completed 3.5 years. I was 18 and a half. I was assigned eventually after basic training to a medical detachment because I had been a pre-med student. Although my job ended up being a litter bearer, which relied more on my brawn than on my brain, but that was the way the Army went. Of course, being in a combat situation, I was absolutely terrified out of my skin. It's a terrifying, frightening, unbearable situation to be under direct fire by artillery, by grenades, by machine gun, by rifle fire. And to know that there are forces and individuals out there who want you dead. But then it got through all kinds of situations. The more frightening one happened after we had gotten into Germany after crossing a couple of rivers at midnight and all kinds of interesting adventures. We were trying to break through the Siegfried Line. It was probably February. Snow was quite deep, and we had to slog across this field from the woods where we had assembled and started across this open field. And when a significant number of troops got across that field, quite visible to the Germans, it was early in the morning, they waited that long and then opened fire. The shells started to fall in the area in the group where I was, and we flung ourselves into the snow and tried to bury down as deep as we could to avoid being hit. And one of my friends in front of me suddenly let out a scream. And I peeked up under my helmet to look up to see what was wrong. And his foot was in front of me about 1.5 to 2 inches. And projecting from his foot was a shell fragment about 8 inches long that had dug into his heel. I thought, oh my God, that missed me by a couple of inches. It would have gone right through my helmet. And I just missed dying at that moment. It brought home, as it had been all along once we were in combat, the fragility of life and how easy it was to die, how easy it was to not be able to do anything about it. And that made it absolutely clear to me that every moment of living was a precious gift, and that it was important to enjoy it and to know that the next instant it could be gone. And the things that I had in my terror thought would never happen, that I would one day fall in love, get married, have children, have a career, the idea of grandchildren never even entered into my mind at that point. I couldn't possibly think that far ahead. And so I feel very fortunate that I've been able, through chance, to continue to live, to have a happy family life, and to have wonderful grandchildren.
Who's your favorite?
Whoever I'm speaking to at the moment.
Good answer.
That was Weekend Edition producer Samantha Balaban speaking to her grandfather, Al Balaban, in 2012. After the war, Al Balaban did live a good, long life. He finished his medical studies and became a psychiatrist. He was married to his wife, Barbara, for more than 70 years. They had 3 children and 5 grandchildren, who called him Papa Al. He died in 2019 at the age of 94. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Industrial fishing is plundering the oceans. According to the United Nations, more than 1/3 of global fish stocks are now being harvested at biologically unsustainable levels. So, can you eat seafood while preserving threatened species? Well, 2 chefs on the French coast of Brittany certainly think so. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports on their crusade to save the seas, one diner at a time.
Hugo Oranger looks out across the Bay of Mont-Saint-Michel from his restaurant, Le Coquillage, tucked inside a gray stone chateau high on a bluff. He says on a clear day, you can see the bay's iconic 10th century island monastery.
If they chose to build the Mont Saint-Michel in this place at that time, there must have been something special going on here.
The free-spirited 37-year-old has just earned his 3rd Michelin star. That's great, he says, but what really compels him is this bay with its vast tides.
And what is the tide? It's a relation with the moon and the sun. Here, we don't cook the same thing when you are in big tide or in low tide.
Because, he says, the fish and shellfish are different at high and low tide. Roulanger's father opened Le Coquillage and earned its 1st Michelin star. As a boy, he says he had no desire to follow in his father's footsteps. He joined the merchant marine as a ship captain, but sailing around the world led him back home.
On the sea, you understand that the earth is mostly liquid. When you are a chef, you can try to protect this.
France is one of the EU's biggest consumers of seafood, with much of it eaten in restaurants. That gives chefs like Roulanger a lot of power over what's served and caught. Down in the kitchen, final preparations for lunch are underway. A sous chef sharpens his knife to fillet a giant sea bass. Roulanger only serves fish in the summer that's caught by local small fishermen. In the winter, we work with crustaceans, shellfish, and algae, Roulanger tells me, switching to French. Because fish have seasons, he says, just like vegetables, and you shouldn't eat them when they're reproducing.
We have to remember that we are eating wild animals. It's like wild game, and it is no banal act to kill and eat fish. The sea is not inexhaustible. Eating fish should be reserved for special occasions.
Hugo's father, Olivier Roulanger, arrives on the bluff.
Bonjour.
This longtime chef, now retired from the kitchen, helped save the threatened bluefin tuna in the aughts. As head of an international hotel restaurant network, he convinced hundreds of chefs across the U.S., Europe, and Japan to take it off their menus. It worked. He says Japanese sushi masters who'd been furious later thanked him when the species was saved.
We saved scallops in this region. 40 years ago, they were becoming extinct, so we restricted the fishing season. Sea bass, you just have to stop eating it in winter for it to come back. Science knows what to do. We just have to follow.
La mer, l'océan.
Roulanger calls the sea humanity's cupboard and small fishermen the key to keeping it stocked. If they disappear, he says, our oceans would be depleted by overfishing and that cupboard would become a trash can. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Brittany.
This is NPR News.
You are listening to Weekend Edition here on KAXE, KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingel. Our listeners love supporting the businesses that support KAXE. If you're interested in connecting with KAXE listeners, call 218-326-1234 to learn about sponsorship opportunities. Big thanks to all our current business supporters. Itasca Housing Resource Team hosts Soup on the Street Wednesday, November 19th on the grounds of Old Central School in Grand Rapids from 3 to 5 p.m. Stand in solidarity with those experiencing housing insecurity and hunger. Donations of hats, mittens, and scarves will be accepted, and soup will be served. The Cass County chapter of the Isaac Walton League will host a spaghetti dinner fundraiser at Union Church in Hackensack Thursday, November 13th at 5 p.m. A presentation on nitrates follows the dinner. Now we'll take you back to Weekend Edition.
I'm Joel Snyder with these headlines. Super Typhoon Fung Wong is battering the Philippines today, the storm dumping heavy rain and has knocked out power and forced more than a million people from their homes. The typhoon last week killed more than 200 people in the Philippines. In Washington, the Senate is expected back in session today, looking for a way to bring the government shutdown to an end. The shutdown has disrupted flights, threatened food assistance that millions of Americans rely on, and left federal workers without pay. It's now in its 40th day. And aviation authorities are grounding the type of airplane that crashed last week in Louisville, Kentucky, killing 14 people. The FAA is grounding McDonnell Douglas MD-11 planes until they can be inspected. UPS and FedEx grounded their MD-11 fleets on Friday. I'm Tyler Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BetterHelp, committed to making mental well-being a priority and offering support in taking on everything life demands. With therapists available to communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public. And from the NPR Wine Club, now shipping to additional states. Whether purchasing a few wines or joining the wine club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe, and it's time to play the puzzle. Joining us, as always, is Will Shortz. He's puzzle editor of the New York Times and puzzle master of Weekend Edition. How's it going, Will?
I'm doing great. How are you, Aisha?
I am doing well. Will, please remind us of last week's challenge.
Yes, it came from Andrew Chaikin of San Francisco. I said, name a popular automobile import, make plus model, add the letter V and anagram the result. You'll name a popular ethnic food. And the answer is the Kia Soul. Add a V and scramble, you get souvlaki.
Oh, okay. There were 545 correct entries, so this might have been a little tricky for folks. This week's winner is Kevin Tinney of Denver, Colorado. Congratulations, Kevin.
Thank you very much.
How long have you been playing the puzzle?
I've been playing for about 5 years, listening for closer to 20.
Okay. And so this is your first time winning.
Indeed.
And apparently this is going to be a surprise for your boys. When they hear this, they'll know the surprise.
Oh, they're going to go nuts.
Because how old are your boys? And they listen to the puzzle?
They do. They're 11 and 9, and they listen with my wife and I every single Sunday morning.
Oh, my goodness. And are they really good at it?
They're getting there.
Okay. Well, we'll have to see how they do today, because you'll be there to get their reaction. What do you do when you're not playing the puzzle?
Hanging out with my family mostly. We spend a lot of time together. We write music and read to each other a lot.
Oh, that is wonderful. Well, Kevin, I have to ask you, are you ready to play the puzzle?
As I'll ever be.
All right. Take it away, Will.
All right, Kevin and Aisha. Every answer is a familiar two-word phrase or name in which the first two letters of each word are the same state postal abbreviation. For example, if I said Colorado, an everyday ailment that there's no cure for, you would say common cold, because the abbreviation for Colorado is CO, and that starts both words common and cold. Here you go. First one is Florida. a sudden rush of water down a stream bed.
Flash flood.
That's right. Wisconsin, an aid in seeing a road when it rains.
Aid when seeing a road. Oh, window.
What's on the front of your car?
Window wiper. Or windshield wiper.
Windshield wipers, right? Louisiana, a deep blue gem with a Latin name.
Ooh, deep blue gem. Louisiana. Lapis.
Maybe I'll just tell you this one. Do you know lapis lazuli?
There you go.
L-A-P-I-S-L-A-Z-U-L-I.
Okay, I wasn't going to get that.
There's your vocabulary builder for the day. Your next one is California, a Christmas tree decoration you can eat.
Candy cane.
That's it. Pennsylvania, a tricky thing to learn to do with a car.
Parallel park.
That's right. Indiana, something a stockbroker is not allowed to share.
Inside information.
Excellent. Alabama, star of MASH.
Alan Alda.
Right. Massachusetts, female disciple who anointed the feet of Jesus.
Mary Magdalene.
That's correct. Maine, tribal doctors.
Medicine men.
That's right. Delaware, an event in which vehicles go around a track crashing into each other.
Demolition derby.
Good job. Georgia, part of the dashboard that measures from full to empty.
Gas gauge.
That's right. Here's your last one. Washington, a city in Washington.
Walla Walla.
You got it. Boy, except for lapis lazuli, you just blazed through that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you didn't even need any help. You just went toot, 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 toot. You were wet, and you were so fast, I was still trying to think of the abbreviation when you had already got it. So, I mean, you did a wonderful job. How do you feel?
I feel fantastic.
For playing our puzzle today, you'll get a weekend edition lapel pin as well as puzzle books and games. You can read all about it at npr.org/puzzle. And Kevin, what member station do you listen to?
We're at 90.1 Colorado Public Radio.
That's Kevin Tinney of Denver, Colorado. Thanks for playing the puzzle. Your boys will be proud.
Thank you.
Okay, Will, what's next week's challenge?
Yes, a funny challenge from Mark Scott of Seattle. Think of a famous actress, first and last names. Interchange the first and last letters of these names. That is, move the first letter of the first name to the start of the last name and the first letter of the last name to the start of the first name. Say the result out loud, and you'll get some advice on fermenting milk. What is it? So again, a famous actress, first and last names. Interchange the first and last letters of those names. Say the result out loud, and you'll get some advice on fermenting milk. What advice is that?
When you have the answer, go to our website, npr.org/puzzle, to submit your response. Just fill out the form on the puzzle page. Remember, just one entry, please. Our deadline for entries this week is Thursday, November 13th at 3 p.m. Eastern. Don't forget to include a phone number where we can reach you. If you're the winner, we'll give you a call. And if you pick up the phone, you'll get to play on the air with the puzzle editor of the New York Times and puzzle master of Weekend Edition, Will Shortz. Thank you, Will.
Thank you, Aisha.
Do you wish your teen would spend less time glued to their phone? Or are you worried about how fixated your toddler seems to be to that tablet? Well, moms and dads, according to a 2024 study from Pediatric Research, one of the strongest predictors of a child's screen time is their parent's screen time. So what does it take to be a good digital role model? Andy Tagle of NPR's Life Kit is here to help us set the tone for technology use in your family home. Hey, Andy.
Hey, Aisha.
So what I'm hearing from this study is that children imitate their parents. Does that mean parents have to swear off their cell phones whenever they're with their kids? You know, zero screen time?
No, definitely not. So any app-happy parents listening can take a deep breath. The answer here is not to go full Luddite. I spoke with Jean Twenge about this. She's a psychology professor and researcher. She just came out with the book, 10 Rules for Raising Kids in a High-Tech World. And on top of knowing a lot about this subject, she's a mom of three, and her guiding philosophy at home is pretty simple. I'd sum it up with just being really intentional with your use of technology, using your devices for what they're good for.
whether that's doing your homework or making that phone call or sending a text, but then trying to focus on other things for the rest of the time. So use it for what it's good for and put it away.
Dwangi isn't saying no tech, but she is kind of saying no more tech than is strictly necessary. One way to do this, anchor points. So ideally, you want to aim for every device to have one specific function or a specific location. For example, you can designate just the TV for entertainment like movies and shows versus the TV and the laptop and the phone. And what that does is keep every corner of the house from being available for screen time 24/7. A similar kind of flip side idea is device-free zones. So those can be physical spaces or times on the schedule or both. So a lot of families go device-free at mealtime, for example. The next one is a biggie, and it's a hard and fast rule for good health that a lot of experts agree on.
So am I going to like what's coming?
You're not going to like it, Aisha. I'm sorry. I know that, like me, you're a fan of falling asleep to the TV. But Dwangi says if there is only one rule you can follow in your home, it should be no electronic devices in the bedroom overnight.
And that's for people of all ages. So a ton of research shows that people do not sleep as well or as long if those devices are in their bedrooms overnight. So even if it's off, that seems to disrupt sleep.
Even if off. Just one example for you. Common Sense Media did a study where they tracked kids' phones. They found that 60% of 11 to 17-year-olds use their phone between midnight and 5 a.m. on school nights.
I believe it. I got them kids.
So a fix here, just having a family charging station in the living room or another communal area. You could also have timed lock boxes, the more extreme version. And then you can maybe invest in a, you know, cute new retro alarm clock.
These all sound like good ideas, but I'm also thinking about how tied my job is to my phone and my laptop. And there are a lot of people out there like me who don't always have a choice to ignore their technology.
Yeah, it's true. Fubbing happens, phone snubbing. So if you have to use your tech around your kids, you can narrate and counterbalance. You can let them know you're not just ignoring them. You want to explain what you're doing and why you're doing it, and then make up for it where you can. So, for example, mom's got to be on a Zoom call for the next 20 minutes. As soon as I'm off, I'll help you get ready for school. And then this afternoon, we're going to the park, just you and me, kid.
That sounds like a plan. Life Kit's Andy Tagle. Thank you so much.
I hope it's helpful, Aisha.
The legend lives on from the Chippewa on down of the big lake they call Gitche-Gumee.
You might not have been able to escape Gordon Lightfoot on social media lately. That's because this week marks the 50th anniversary of the actual wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald.
With a load of iron ore, 26,000 tons more than the Edmund Fitzgerald weighed empty.
The freighter went down in a storm on Lake Superior. The entire crew died. Tomorrow on Morning Edition, the story behind that tragedy and how it was immortalized by a song that became a surprise hit. Listen, telling your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name.
As the big freighters go, it was bigger than most, with a crew and a captain well seasoned. Concluding some terms with a couple of steel firms when they left fully loaded for Cleveland.
The musician Ali Fox knows how hard it is to see someone you love in pain and not be able to help.
My friend from home, we grew up together since we were like children. And he had lost his dad, who was like my second dad. And we were in this funny phase of like hanging out but not really saying a word.
Ali Fox tried to start a conversation with his friend Dan, but didn't get far.
I had asked Dan like how he was feeling, and I could see the words like almost like on his tongue, and then instantly just bite his tongue and be like, yeah, no, not bad, not bad at all. It's like the most heartbreaking thing to see, and it's such a small like micro emotion to see on someone's face, but when you know them well enough, it's like massive. It's like a billboard, you can read it so easily.
Ali Fox is one part of the indie rock duo Good Neighbors, along with Scott Verrill.
The two musicians told NPR that Dan's story, as well as their own early life experiences, inspired their song, Ripple.
When you are growing up, especially in the smaller towns, this can be anywhere in the UK or the US, and it's not very easy to talk about emotions without being sort of made fun of or people not taking you too seriously. I definitely come from like a grin and bear it family. And so I found the only way I could fully talk about things without being like told off instantly or like anyone pushing back on what I said was music.
Well, this is Scott. Similar to Ollie, I grew up around London. You know, I went to a boys' school and I wasn't in like creative circles as such. And then I think being in my 20s and surrounded by so many songwriters and producers that are so open, it's like something that I'm still learning, and especially from like Ollie as well, just about like being honest. We kind of got fed up with music sounding really sad. So that was kind of why we wanted to flip it into a different sound, but keep the same message.
We have this sort of like blue sky mentality towards everything that we talk about, whether it is grief or whether it's like losing someone or breaking up with someone. We always try and frame it in this optimistic light just to sort of open the conversation a bit wider. So when I was saying, if ever you're feeling low, honey, kick your feet, I can feel the ripples pull you from the stream. That was like for when Dan felt ready to talk. Kick your feet, I'll be able to see it from the like the banks of the stream. And then I'll know to come and like pull you out of it. My friend Dan, like he was just sort of bopping along to the song. And I was like, you know, this one's about Harv, which is his dad. And he's like, is it? He's not one to maybe listen to lyrics. And so when he finally listened to them, he was like crying on the other end of the phone. He's like, thanks so much, it like means the world. And at this point, we'd had the conversations that had lifted the weight. So it was a real nice full circle moment for him to realize that the whole time, me and all his mates were caring about him. Just want people to feel comfortable talking about things. I definitely think around grief and around the darker emotions, I don't think there's any shame. So just as long as our songs can resonate with someone so much that it inspires them to open the conversation a little bit, I think that would be like, that's our job done, really.
That's Ollie Fox and Scott Verrill, the duo behind the band Good Neighbors. They recently released a new album called Blue Sky Mentality. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley-Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. We receive support from Lakeland PBS, offering 24/7 PBS Kids programming, the PBS Kids video app, educational resources for teachers, parents, and more at lptv.org. The classic movie series continues at the Edge Center for the Arts in Big Fork, Thursday, November 13th. This month's film is Rio Bravo, starring John Wayne, Dean Martin, and Ricky Nelson. The movie starts at 6:30. The History of Jazz airs Saturdays at noon and Sundays at 4 with host Paul Kivi, exploring the distinctly American art form. Hear more Jazz Sundays at 6 p.m. with volunteer-hosted Jazz on America Avenue. The Central Lakes College Music Department presents Elucidation, an ensemble concert Monday, November 10th at 7 p.m. at the Chalberg Theater on the Brainerd campus. The mountain bike trails at Tioga Recreation Area near Cohasset will be closed now through November 23rd due to deer.